Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Dan Atkinson. I'm the Director of Arts, Humanities, and Languages at UC San Diego Extension, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all here tonight to this event in our Revell Forum series at the Neurosciences Institute. It's my pleasure now to introduce Mary Walshock, who will introduce tonight's speaker. Mary is Associate Vice Chancellor for Public Programs and Dean of University Extension at UC San Diego. And it's her vision for UC San Diego Extension that provides the inspiration for programs like this one that enrich lives of literally tens of thousands of San Diegans each year. So please join me now in welcoming Mary Walshock.
I'm really pleased to introduce Joel Kotkin tonight. Some of you in the audience who know me know I'm a sociologist, a passionate regionalist, very interested in California and the future of the entire country. And Joel Kotkin, for over three decades, has been addressing these sorts of issues and is a widely published journalist and a prolific author. He currently writes the weekly New Geographer column for Forbes.com. He previously wrote the monthly Grassroots Business column in the New York Times Sunday Business section. And he has served as the West Coast editor for Inc. magazine, and that was for 5 years, and he continues to contribute to that publication. His work also appears in the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, the Washington Post, The American, and of course on the web, on Politico.com. Mr. Kotkin is a distinguished presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University in nearby Orange, California, and also an adjunct fellow with the Legatum Institute based in London. He consults for many economic development organizations and in association with the La Jolla Institute, not based in La Jolla, but in Claremont, has been doing a number of studies of suburban America and of places such as Salinas, California, New York's middle class, an economic vision for the city of Ontario, California, and he's currently finishing a major study for the La Jolla Institute on the Four Corners region of Southern California, and an international study for his colleagues in London on urban upward mobility, a very versatile and diverse portfolio. He has authored seven critically acclaimed books. I won't go through the long list. I especially love Tribes, Joel, because it captured the diversity of this country in unique and oftentimes inspiring ways. And tonight, he's going to talk to us about his newest volume, published earlier this month. He's on a long book tour, has a sore throat. There's plenty of water up here. The book, The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Please join me in welcoming Joel Kotkin.
Well, one good thing about speaking in Southern California is I don't have to apologize for taking the water. That's always something that you feel guilty about. Or not. Anyway, I'm really glad to be here. I'm very honored that you all came out on this for Southern California chilly night to come hear me. And I'm going to try to just give you some basic ideas about what's in the book, and then I'm really thrilled to get your questions. Because I think I'm raising a lot of issues. You know, you start off with, you always ask the question, why am I doing this? Why am I writing this book? And I think more than anything else, I had been, for the last 20, 30 years, been following demographics pretty carefully. And in a book I co-authored in 1988, we looked at the issue of demographics in Europe and Japan and the United States in a book basically about Asia, with my co-author was a Japanese woman, and we found something really interesting, which is that we started to see this tremendous divergence in the birth rates of the United States on one hand and Europe and Japan on another. And when the United States population passed 300 million several years ago, the Wall Street Journal and others were asking, asked me to write about it, and I became really taken with why is this happening and what does it mean? And so that's basically what the book is about. Now, one of the things that's very critical to understand is back in the 1960s, and all of you are too young to remember the 60s, that there was a belief, late 60s, early 70s, that that humanity was in an absolute steamroller towards disaster, that we were absolutely going to go through massive starvation. There was a book called The Population Bomb and many others around it, which were extraordinarily negative about the future of humanity. And they often predicted that by the late 70s, early 80s, there would be mass starvation on a global level. One of the people who was a supporter of this view, who happens to be the science advisor to the current president of the United States, wrote in, I believe it was the mid-80s, that countries in the Far East would never, and in South Asia, would never progress further because there wouldn't be enough energy and food for them to do so. Well, having spent a lot of time in China back in the early 80s and following what's been going on since then, I think something happened. Having just come back a few weeks ago from India, something's happening. So the world is not as bleak a place as has been often thought, and is, again, we're going through another phase of that. Now, that one part of that is global, and a lot of it is still based on population. Now, what seems to be happening with population internationally, and then I'll get to the specifics of the U.S. and its competitors, what seems to be happening globally is the growth rate has slowed considerably. As people urbanize, majority of people live in cities, as women go into the workforce, as education increases, as people are doing things other than working on a farm, you begin to see a ratcheting down of birth rates in the developing countries. There are still some that have high birth rates, but those have come down. And if you go to a place like Mumbai or Mexico City, as I've been recently, their birth rates are not that much higher than they are in the United States. So we're going to have a very interesting and challenging four decades ahead of us. By about 2050, the birth rate seems to get to a point where the world population may not grow very much more beyond 9 billion. It's currently 6 billion. So there's a lot of challenge there. But I do think that human beings will find a way to accommodate this, and we can discuss that later as well. Now, there's another phenomenon that has not been written about as much until at least the last few years, and that is the fact that there is such a thing as too low a birth rate. We had the usual assumption that if people stopped having children, that was always a good thing. And on some level, perhaps it is. If you are one of these people who believes human beings are the AIDS of the earth or a cancer, maybe, you know, the quicker we are eradicated, the better. But if you don't happen to feel that way, there's some very serious issues in a society that has not enough children. And what we're seeing now is in Japan, in Russia, in most of the EU, in South Korea, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, the beginnings of what is a new phenomenon in global history, which is the evolution of societies to being heavily aged and actually having more older people than young people. By 2050, Japan's population will not only be smaller, but it will be probably somewhere around 35 to 40% over 65. We have no idea how societies will deal with this. We know we've had villages, rural villages in many countries where this has happened. It doesn't bode all that terribly well. The Japanese, of course, have really recognized that there's a problem there. In the last presidential election, it's quite interesting. First time that the issue of fertility became, in recent history, that became a big issue. And both parties struggling to try to show who was going to do something about the birth rate. And it reminds me of my friend of mine, Bill Fry, who's a demographer at Brookings, and Bill went to Japan, and they said, I don't know, how do these Americans have all these kids? So I said to Bill, well, you know what, if they have to ask that question, they're in more trouble than I thought. But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. is going on a very divergent course in terms of its population. And although our population is aging, and because of the various social factors, we do have less of a birth rate than we might have had, let's say, in the 1950s. The U.S. population will probably grow between 2000 and 2050 to about 400 million. It could be more, it could be a little bit less, but since I probably won't be around here, you can't call me on it anyway. But I think we are going to see some steady growth. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you take a look at workforce growth, which is the people going into school, people who are going to be in the workforce, people who are going to innovate, people who are going to have new ideas, basically the group starting at 15, going to 64, the growth rate in the United States will be about 40% by 2050 from 2000. The growth rate in the EU will be minus 25. In South Korea, I believe it's minus 31. Russia, it may be more than that. And in Japan, it'll be over minus 40. So what you're basically beginning to see already today are the outlines. What this book in some ways is I can see what is happening at the current level and starting to imagine where does that take you in 20, 30, 40 years. And it's already clear, even after the economic crisis, which we so brilliantly helped cook up for the world, nevertheless, many of our competitors are now doing worse than we are. And one of the factors is lack of a young workforce, lack of a kind of, sort of civic energy that would have been very useful in these times and will be more useful in the future. So what you've seen predominantly is the United States as a great outlier among the major industrialized countries. Even China, which now still has a huge surging workforce, will also begin to age. By 2050, maybe there'll be as many as 400 million people in China over 65. They don't have much of a social security system. The other thing is that China has this other little problem that people tend to ignore. There are about 23 million more eligible males of marrying age than females. Now, how did that happen? Well, Mao Zedong wanted to increase China's population, so he just said, pump them out as fast as possible. This was going to make China a great power. Deng Xiaoping takes power and said, oh, my God, we got to do something. One child. Now, here are the unintended consequences. Are very interesting. What happens with that policy is they begin to have screening. They can do a little ultrasound, and if there's nothing between the legs, that means one thing. And if there's something between the legs, it probably means something else. In a culture which favors male over female, this has meant an enormous disequilibrium. So China is certainly going to have a major demographic problem. So if we go down the road and we look at the next 20, 30 years, demographically, the United States is not going to have a huge population explosion, but it will continue to have a better balance between young and old and obviously male and female. Might even have a little advantage in female because many of the children being adopted from, particularly from China, are female as opposed to male. But fundamentally, you're going to have relatively young demographics. In many ways, this is very good for the country. It means innovation. It means youthful energy, the ability to reinvent the world to that really is unique to younger people. It will mean a growing domestic market for U.S. Companies. It will mean that the older people will have people who might actually keep Social Security halfway solvent. There may be young people that take care of older people when they need it later in life. So this is an extraordinarily positive side of this. And people say to me, well, you really want 100 million more people? And, you know, first of all, I say, well, you know, I'm not responsible. I didn't get these people pregnant. You know, they're pregnant on their own. They didn't ask me. But the fact of the matter is, this is already happening. I mean, you would get close to 400 million if immigration was cut in half and we had a 20, 30-year recession. I don't think we will, because a recession will slow down birth rates. But I think that fundamentally it's a positive thing if we meet some challenges. And when you think about the negative side, the downside, the most important issue is what you would call upward mobility. Will there be jobs and wealth creation for this generation? And those of you who are in college now know what it's like on the other side of the college, that you know that there aren't a lot of jobs out there. That's going to be a big challenge. That's going to be the fundamental challenge of this society in the next 20, 30 years. So the young population is an opportunity to move forward. an opportunity for the United States to be the preeminent country in the world still in 30 or 40 years, which I think is likely. On the other hand, there's a huge challenge in terms of our infrastructure investment, our education investment, in terms of what we need to do, in terms of our industrial base, in terms of agriculture. Great challenges. But what the book tries to do is say, here are the challenges that we have, and we have to look at them. And we have to understand that European society and Japanese society have fundamentally different problems. We cannot say, well, we're going to be just like Denmark. Well, can't just be like Denmark. We can't be like Germany if we wanted to be for some unknown reason, because these societies are going to have very different situations. They're going to have fewer people, older people, small workforces, shrinking workforces, very different set of challenges. So on that level, I think the United States is well positioned, but we certainly need to take advantage of that situation and prepare for it. And that preparation could be many things. Certainly infrastructure is a huge part of it. Anyone who lives in California today knows how bad many of the roads are. I was in the Bay Area driving from Petaluma, and I said, I'll go through San Francisco. And the roads were in such bad shape, I was 2 weeks later in Mexico City and said, God, Mexico City roads seem to be better than California roads. This is not good. So there's much that has to be done. There's much that has to be done in the United States in dealing with particularly the issues of the working class and of those kids who are not going to go to four-year schools and probably shouldn't go to four-year schools. I don't think we need to shove everybody through four-year schools. I mean, you know, have a kid go to a Cal State and get a degree in postmodernist English, well, as we used to say in New York, that and a subway type token will get you a ride on the subway. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. You're just adding on debt. What we need to do is think about how we can get people in productive industries. When I speak to business groups, they never say, oh, my God, if we only had some more PhDs in postmodernism, that would solve our problems. I mean, they say that even less than they say, well, we need more lawyers. But what they will say is we need welders, we need technicians, we need plumbers, we need competent office help, we need people who can run machine tools. All those kinds of jobs are generally in any sort of growth economy in great demand. And one of the things I've done working in communities is try to work with them on how do we take this population that's probably not going to go to a four-year school. They may go and drop out, or they're going to come out with a degree probably not worth a lot, and say, how can we steer them into something that's going to be more productive for them and for the economy? And I'm happy to say in some of these communities, people are listening, and we're making those changes. So fundamentally, the higher population requires enormous amounts of changes. And the enormous population also means a focus on upward mobility. You know, people say, well, what are you politically? Are you liberal or conservative? And I describe myself as a Pat Brown, Harry Truman Democrat. To me, the Democratic Party was really about raising up the working class and the middle class to get their aspirations, to live a better life. Unfortunately, today, many of the progressives are not about that at all. They don't want people to live in suburbs. They don't want them to drive cars. They don't want them particularly to have a much better life. It's not that they want them to do badly. They just don't prioritize this as an issue. And I think that fundamentally we need to understand that this issue of upward mobility is absolutely the critical issue in maintaining the democracy that we have. Another reason why this is going to be important is another aspect that I talk about a great deal in the book, and that is the ethnic change of the United States. The United States that I grew up in, and I was a young person, that first time I went to Washington, D.C. was 1959. My parents took me actually down to Williamsburg. We're driving along the highway, and I see these signs saying colored. And I said, Dad, what is colored? And he said, those are hotels that the black people can go to. And I couldn't believe it, but obviously it was true. It was the end of Jim Crow. So in one not that long life, I can remember that and now can see an African-American president and two African-American secretaries of state before him. What has amazed me is if you took a time traveler from 1960 and put him in America today, he would be so shocked, or she would be so shocked, by the diversity of the country and the intermingling that it would be a revelation. It would be like, this isn't even possible. It's almost like Edward Bellamy and looking backwards, going in and going to Boston 100 years later, and you barely recognize anything. Now, my own daughter, older daughter, when I talked to her about the colored hotel, she said, no way. And I said, being a good San Fernando Valley dad, yes way. This is the way the world was. And we are in a world now where you see a multiracial couple. Nobody really cares. And that's not just here in California. I travel all over the country. It just is not that big a deal anymore. If you take the surveys of people over 65, only 45% approve of interracial dating. Among young people, the millennial generation after 1983, it's about 95% approve. We are seeing projections as high as one out of every five Americans by 2050 will be multiracial. Multiracial marriages are the fastest growth in the marriage business, and I think we will see more and more of it. So America will become what Walt Whitman described as a race of races. This is pretty unique in a global sense, because it's unique because many of our competitors are really not capable of doing anything like this. China, Japan, Korea, very much homogeneous societies with very little likelihood of integrating immigrants. Europe has been a little more of a mixed question, but they are not doing all that terribly well either. When you go to Holland or Denmark, it doesn't take long before you start hearing things about immigrants that are pretty nasty, and that you have a very hard situation with the integration of immigrants into the European societies. So this is a great advantage to America. Now, to hold this together, we're going to need economic growth, and we're going to need infrastructure, and we're going to need upward mobility, because all of those things are part of what diverts people away from the race issue to different issues. I believe that the big issue in America in the next 30, 40 years will be class, not race. It will be upward mobility economically, and much less about culture wars. I think the culture wars, in the book I say, they're kind of over. I mean, there are some fringe people out there on the right and some fringe people out there on the left, and they get a lot of attention, and everyone wishes they would just go away. I don't think that there is this kind of huge animus that we think about cultural issues. There are disagreements, but it's not as important as it once was. We find that evangelicals, who are considered to be one of the conservative groups in the society, and yet when I was working in Houston, Texas on and doing a lot of work with Katrina refugees, the group that was probably the most useful in that process, and I think Mayor Bill White would agree with this, were the evangelical churches, mostly the white evangelical churches. Now, obviously, the African-American churches played a big role, too, but it's very interesting. Their attitudes, very interesting change. You know, the whole holdover of that kind of racist feeling that was so prevalent in the in conservative Christianity in America 30, 40 years ago is just barely there anymore. So we have progress in that area. And I think that has international implications, because we're living in an era in which economic power in the world is shifting from Europe to Asia. I've been writing about that for as long as I've been writing, since 1982. And that process has taken place and continues to take place. But America is a country that is no longer a European country, and it will not be a European country. It will have antecedents in Europe, but its fundamental culture, its reality, will be a very mixed reality. And this is really part of a projection of American society, really, that has its base in the past. If you think about the early period of the Republic in the 1790s, 1800s, it was a predominantly Anglo-Saxon society with a few Germans and Dutch. And, of course, a slave population that was completely in the background. Benjamin Franklin, a very progressive person in many ways, was very worried about the Germans were going to Germanize us. When the Irish came and they were saying, oh, the drunken hordes of Irishmen are going to ruin the country. Then you got the Italians, and the New York Times said that the Italians were the Chinese of Europe. And I don't think they were talking about the fact that they cooked really well. It was sort of a nefarious characterization. Then you had, the even worse, you get people like my grandparents coming here, and the great sociologists, and why I'm a little skeptical about scientists, went to Ellis Island, and they said, okay, we're going to check out these people, and they said 83% are mental defectives. Now, you might think, hearing this speaker, that this might be a hereditary issue, but fundamentally, I don't think most Jews were mental defectives. There were a lot of other things, but they weren't that. So what you have is a society that is just progressing into this ever more diverse, ever more multifaceted population on so many different levels. And that is the great blessing of this country and the great strength of this country, and will be the thing that no other major country will have. Now, there are countries, Canada and Australia, which also have some of these same characteristics. But they're small societies, relatively limited numbers of people, and I don't think that they will carry the weight in the world that the United States will have. So we have all these aspects of America. We have the racial ones. We talk about the demographic. How are Americans going to live? This is probably, in some ways, the most controversial aspect of the book. It is widely believed that as the country gets more populated, majority of that population, the vast majority, should be living in dense urban areas. The only problem with that is that's not what people want. If you can go through survey after survey for the last 50 years, including that the last few years, somewhere around 10 to 20% of the population wants to live in what you might call an urban environment. Now, in much of the United States, still, that urban environment is a single-family house on a tree-lined street. You could say, I live in an urban environment. I live in a place called Valley Village. Valley Village is a predominantly single-family home neighborhood, but it's 10 minutes from downtown Hollywood, 15 minutes downtown Hollywood, houses built in the 1930s. But the vast majority of Americans, for most of their lives, will continue to live in suburban areas. What will happen to American cities? Well, I think we will have urban growth. If you have 10 to 20 million people, that's 10, 20% of this 100 million, moving to cities, you're going to have all the urban growth that these cities could conceivably have the infrastructure to handle. So there will be a renaissance potentially in urban America, but it will not be the predominant place where people live. Now it is true that if we got rid of of our democracy and we told people, you have to live this way, that may be a way of doing it. But for most people, for most of their lives, and usually in their 20s is sort of their urban period, by the time they get into their 30s and they think about having children, they think about buying a house or starting a business, most of those people will end up living in suburbs for all sorts of very prosaic reasons. Now, will those suburbs be the same as the suburbs that many of us grew up in? I think they're going to change tremendously. One, I think these suburbs are going to become more and more centers onto themselves. Many of them have developed town centers. Many of them will have, of course, a large amount of the employment, which is already taking place. A large proportion of the population will work from home. You have about 30 million now. By 2016, it's estimated will be 60 million. Those people will not, some of them will be living in urban areas and rural areas, but most will probably be in the suburbs. The suburbs are becoming increasingly diverse. If you read accounts of suburbia in the 1950s and 60s, it was a place for white people. In the San Fernando Valley where I live, basically you have somewhere around half the population is non-white. In 1970, it was 95% white. If you want to find good Chinese food in the United States, the best place to go is the San Gabriel Valley, east of LA. It is one Chinese suburb after another. If you want to find good Indian food, you go out to the outskirts of Houston, and you'll see it there. And what you'll see is the churches and the Hindu temples and the Buddhist temples congregating, not in the cities, but in the suburbs. Because immigrants, as much if not more than any group in American society, aspire to the basic single-family house and the backyard. Now, many of them won't make it, but they certainly want that to be the case. How will these suburbs fit environmentally? Well, I think one thing is we'll have more people working closer to home. In many suburbs, the commutes are actually shorter than they are in some of the urban areas. You'll start seeing higher percentages of people working at home. I think that there are many things that can be done with planting trees and buying open space to create what I call green urbia. And I think that's the way to go. The environmental movement, unfortunately, has married itself to some extent with the smart growth and the new urbanist groups and decided that everybody's got to live in a box and take a little choo-choo train to work. The problem is the train has to take you to a job center, and in most American city metropolitan regions, less than 10% of the employment is downtown. So it doesn't necessarily work all that well. The other thing that is unlikely to happen is that people who are living in these suburban areas will give up their homes when they get older and move into the city. That was one of the most hyped myths ever. The work on the demographics is a very small percentage. Many of the people who did it were very wealthy, but they must have been related to newspaper reporters, because it was being written about all the time. And what happens is actually most people retire in place, about 70%. Fewer and fewer are moving off to Florida or Arizona to retire. They're staying home. Now, why are they staying home? One, they've already bought their homes, and they, in many cases, own the homes outright. Their friends are there. Their church is there. Their association is there. The park they like to go walking on the weekends or during the week is there. They may be still working. One interesting thing about America is our population ages, our people are working longer. They're working into their 60s and 70s, something that you don't see in too many countries. So they're going to stay near where their jobs are. The other thing is that their kids are going to, unfortunately, in this recession, move back with them. About 12% of households, I think, in the last year have experienced something like that. I know my daughter goes by her bedroom and says, that's mine when I'm 18. So she's taking dibs on it. But also what's really interesting to me is that our families are becoming, in many ways, closer. When you examine the attitudes of millennials as opposed to the boomers, millennials actually like their parents. Generally speaking, boomers had lots of problems with their parents. You ask them, how often do you talk to your parents or communicate with them? It could be twice a week, three times a week. So there's much, much less conflict. And many of the grandparents will stay or move to the places that their children and grandchildren are. This notion that we had, and the real estate industry is paying a massive price for this miscalculation, that a lot of people were saying, the empty nest is once a kid grows up, we're going to move away. And we're going to, you're going to get a ponytail and buy a Porsche and you're going to zip around downtown. Fact is, not very many people did that. Parents are parents whether their kids are living with them or not. They still care about them. They still worry about what's going to happen to them. If they have grandchildren, they like to have them visit too. So that web of relationships becomes more important and is going to become increasingly important. Now, people say, well, are you talking about the 1950s? And it's very interesting. The 1950s was not normality. This is the great mistake conservatives make. They think the 1950s was sort of some sort of halcyon era. It was a complete exception. For most of American history, we had fairly unstable or what you might call protean families or flexible families where people came in and pinch hit, aunts, uncles, grandparents, brothers, sisters, for lots of interesting reasons. Now, one was immigration. Immigration, lots of people got left on the other side of the pond. And that created many changes. Of course, going on the Western settlement, people got left behind. A lot of people died. Now, it's not our situation now, but what we're seeing is strong families, but the families are somewhat or often unconventional. But that doesn't mean that they're not important. And I think that this is a very critical thing. The conservatives miss that society has moved from 1950 and that 1950 was an exception. Liberal progressives miss the idea that the family is the bedrock of society. You can't possibly have a society of 400 million people that functions without a strong family culture. The other thing I think you're going to see is we're going to see a greater amount of community in the sense of people caring about what we call localism. And that means that people are more about identifying where they live. And you can see this in all sorts of ways. Farmers markets, there were a handful of them in California. There are, I think, 500 or 600 now. That's a place where people meet and greet. Neighborhoods. When I first moved to Los Angeles, you would have just vast stretches. Oh, yeah, it's somewhere between Woodman and Coldwater Canyon. And you would give these kind of axes. Now, oh, that's Valley Village or Valley Glen. Some of these are real names. Some of them are made up. But they're neighborhoods that have a sense of who they are and what they are. And they have neighborhood events. And you're seeing more and more of that. So I think as we look at the future, this idea of a nation of strangers and, you know, the breakdown of the family turns out to be not quite as true as people often believe. And I think as our society gets larger, more complex, what President Jefferson called the little republics become more important. Because I don't think that anyone can run a country of 400 million people intelligently. You could only run it in a dictatorial manner. So a country of 400 million is going to have lots of different ways of doing things. And I think this is one of the mistakes that both political parties make. The Republicans want to impose a kind of very much Southern uniform view of how society should function. And the progressives want to turn the whole country into San Francisco, which... In some ways, I was just came back. It always reminds me of sort of Hong Kong on Valium or something. But the fact of the matter is most people want to be able to choose how they deal with it. And I think we should have experimentation. I just wrote a column in Forbes about what you call Ecotopia, the area from Seattle down to San Francisco. Yeah, kind of wacky politics in some ways. I said, let them be wacky. Let them go and try. Maybe we'll learn something from them. Maybe good and maybe some bad. I mean, within reason, within basic constitutional framework, we should allow for more localism, more experimentation at the local level. Because these little republics are what America is all about. It's why this country functions at the size that it does and why it's been able to hold together under basically one constitution with one civil war since the 1780s. So I think this is another critical part of America in 2050. So if you want to put it all together, what do I see America as? Well, I don't see America as this sort of hegemonic world power that tells everybody what to do. I don't think you prove yourself as a great power by going around and shooting people. Sometimes you have to, but that's really not your qualification. We have to remember the United States is not a... empire in the sense of Rome. It is what Jefferson again called an empire for liberty. It was an idea that we had a way of being that would be an exemplar to the rest of the world. Now, we cannot make the rest of the world be who we are. You know, I mean, we can't, you know, we can hope that the people in Iran who are fighting for their rights succeed. We should support them as we can. But we can't fundamentally impose that. Our best strategy to retain our preeminence is to be a better country and to be a stronger country and to be a fairer country and to be a more diverse country and to be a more productive country. Those are the priorities that we need to have. So at the end of the day, people say, why did you write this book? They go back to the original question. And I think about it in this way. I think the boomer generation, of which I'm a member, have really screwed things up. We've been extremely self-indulgent. We even see boomer writers saying, well, what's going to happen to the suburbs when the boomers get old? Well, your kids, do you ever hear of them? There's another generation. There's all these immigrants coming in. And you find that the boomers sort of, in some senses, have also become very addicted to very negative view of the future. You know, the world without us, humans are our cancer, humans are evil because they're immoral, whatever it is. And we project that on the next generation. So what I wanted to do was to say, okay, look, here are the challenges, but this is where this country is going. There's a great future for this next generation. And of course, I think about my students at Chapman and students that I meet speaking at other places and say, you know what? They don't necessarily have to agree with me. You know, a lot of times they don't. But I want to say, here's a future that's usable. Just like you need a usable past, you need a usable future. And I think that's what the book is. It's a usable future. It's a beginning. It's not an end. You know, people in Washington said, well, what do you think about tax policy? I said, you know what? That's your problem. That's for other people to think about. I barely can get through my taxes. I'm not going to worry about taxes policy. There are people who get paid lots of money to worry about that. There are all sorts of things that people need to do. You know, do I have a formula, a secret sauce to get where I want to go? No. All I have is a vision and a hope, and I have two young daughters who I want to know are going to go into a world that can be better, and hopefully they'll make it better. And that's really why I wrote the book. And I really hope that at the end of the day, the book will mean, not necessarily people will all agree with me or think that this is the way to go, but they'll start thinking about, how do we accommodate those next few generations? What are our obligations to them? And if I can make that contribution, then I feel I've done something. Thank you very much. Of the different regions of the U.S., which one will grow or prosper more than others? Will the Sun Belt New South continue to thrive? Will California solve its current problems? Well, I do that, I get a Nobel Prize. Will the Rust Belt come back? These are great. Would you expect the East and West Coast to be more like Europe? Well, very, very good question. So I'm going to try to deal with all of them. I think that different regions will do differently, that's for sure. I think there's a great opportunity for the center part of the country, which is now underpopulated, underpriced, and offers a very good quality of life to people. The Sun Belt, I think the Sun Belt or the New South is it's really sort of almost two different places now. There's kind of the land speculation, housing boom south, the places like Florida, Nevada, Arizona, and they're going to take a while to come out of this. I think they will, but I think they're going to have a rougher time. But there are also places in the south which have dealt with the basics of manufacturing, infrastructure, job creation. Thinking of Dallas, Houston. Dallas, I believe, is now the fourth largest metropolitan region in the United States. These places have made enormous progress. Again, if you had a time traveler coming from 1960, that traveler was coming from a place where Cleveland and Pittsburgh were infinitely more important than Dallas. You would not say that. You could put Pittsburgh and Cleveland inside Dallas and miss it. So I think that those parts of the country that have focused on the essentials, I think will do really well. The Rust Belt Midwest, a wonderful question. You know, and I think about urbanism this way. The fact is, the reason there won't be much more movement into a San Francisco, New York, simply it's too expensive. You cannot afford to live there and have a decent quality of life. I did a whole study on New York. Was a real estate agent in Queens said to me, well, most of the people that buy a house, even in working class Queens, have to have a parent as a cosigner because of the size of the down payments. So I would think that there is an opportunity for a great urban lifestyle in places like St. Louis, which have beautiful neighborhoods with great houses near gorgeous parks. And I think if the movement you know, which is a subset of the population that likes an urban lifestyle, I think that these are places that could come back very, very well. The question is, will the governments continue to make mistakes? I got contacted by people in Cleveland about 6 months ago, and they said, we have this great vision. We're going to, there's not a major new modern port in the entire Great Lakes area, and we think there's going to be all this growth and potential for trade and manufacturing tied to trade. So we're going to take the some of the older parts of the town. We're going to redo it as a major new port. We're going to take the old port and move and create a new downtown. And I said, God, that sounds really exciting, really interesting way of reinventing Cleveland. They said, it's either that or a convention center. They built the convention center. You know, so, I mean, cities will have to make the right choices. And some of them will and some of them won't. West Coast, East Coast to be more like Europe, yes. Particularly if you take a look at places like San Francisco and Portland. The only thing about Portland is they want to be like Amsterdam with the bicycles, except they have hills. So, and they really don't have a great cardiac hospital yet. So, I think there's going to be a little bit of a problem there. But there's going to be similarities. There are the little Europes of America, and they will look that way. The good thing is that they're great places. They're wonderful places to visit. They're great places to live if you can afford to live there. And it'd be nice if you had a job. Okay, on my on multicultural and racial society, why the world catchphrase now with educational institutions is globalism? You know, it's interesting. I think there is a greater interest in international cultures, and I would ascribe some of it to the diversity of the United States. Nothing wrong with globalism being an interesting field to study. I think it's great that people are going and having study abroad for a year or even living abroad for a while. So I don't see that as a contradiction. I think this is something also about a very different kind of America that's evolving, that, you know, leads by example instead of through either violence, ignorance, or both. How will society with the many children who are born into poverty and unattentive or virtually non-existent parents? Well, this is also a huge issue, and that's one of the things that I work on. I almost always work on in working class neighborhoods and communities. Even the work I'm doing in London was a lot of it had to do with people out in Essex and people in some of the areas on the East End. And I think this is the great challenge of our society. Now, the birth rates among the poor are not as high as they used to be, which is positive, but I think society has to prioritize it. I remember I was speaking in Denver, and the mayor is a very bright man, and he was saying, well, you know, we're going to get all these PhDs from Stanford, and, you know, that's going to lead our society. And I said, Mr. Mayor, what about the 50% of the population that doesn't graduate high school? And I think this is going to be something we have to focus on. That's why one of the ideas I suggested, which, of course, nobody took up, was the idea of bringing back the WPA, the old New Deal program, this huge population of young people with no jobs, no skills, put them to work, $12 an hour fixing bridges, fixing roads, planting trees, and even some of them could even be doing public art. This helped a whole generation of young Americans who were coming out of a destroyed rural environment or tough urban neighborhoods, because believe me, the urban neighborhoods that are now celebrated by new urbanists weren't so nice when they were there before, as my mother is always telling me since she grew up in Brownsville. So I think we have to focus very much on that, and that's one of my biggest concerns with this society, is are we going to focus on these young kids, giving them some sort of option to make a living and make it in society? What is the satisfaction of a grassy yard for family economics? All right, you know what the advantage of a grassy yard is? A, it's privacy. B, your kids go out and play, and you don't have to watch them. I could be in my office, my wife could be in her office, and we can both look out and see the kids play outside. I think people who don't understand the value of yards
almost always never have kids. I mean, it's just, most people do not, it's very difficult to live in an urban environment with no yard, with kids, particularly as they get older. What we found in Manhattan is at age 5, Manhattan was about even with the national average in terms of children compared to the national average at age 5. By age 14, it was way down. Because, you know, they start getting ambulatory, for one thing, and then you need more room. What role do you see architects and planners playing in the development of suburbs and cities? And what leads community to reform? That's a really good question. Somebody's a good student here. What role do you see architects and planners playing? Well, given what a lot of architects and planners want, hopefully not much. I'm not necessarily sure that they've done such a great job. There are some great examples of things that have been done. I would look at Valencia and Woodlands as good examples. Certainly there are many cities in Europe that were very well developed. But the second, leads me to that second question, is community or form. I think that there is this notion that if you have the right form, that will lead to community. Well, UCI did some very interesting work on this, and there was also a whole series of surveys in the book. We talk about this. In the book, there are many indications that people who live in suburbs are more community involved than people who live in cities. People who live in cities tend to be younger. They tend to be more mobile. They are in a place for a relatively short period of time, more likely to be a renter. So it turns out that density does not lead necessarily to community. Now, you could say, well, somebody lives in a McMansion on a 5-acre lot is probably not going to be having much to do with his neighbors. But in a neighborhood of conventional single-family homes on 6,000-7,000 square-foot lots, I think there's a lot of community going on in those places. So I think that, can we design communities better? Yes, I think you can make it more friendly to bikes. You can make it more friendly to telecommuting. And I think you could develop a lot of your local downtowns. Now, many cities in this country, particularly outside of the real Sunbelt areas, have existing downtowns that have been redone and can function very well. I think those work really successfully. Let's see. Then, do I think that AARP will survive? Wow. Maybe put it this way. I have great respect for AARP, but I think the word retirement is probably not on the agenda the way it was before. You know, our conventional sense of retirement, somebody got to be 65, they've been working at General Motors for 30 years, they're pretty physically spent, they have no fantasy of going back on the assembly line. They're happy to be retired, and they're going to go and go play golf for 5 years until they can't do anything else. I think that's going to be a big change. I think people in their 60s and 70s are going to be huge contributors to this next wave of innovation. Young people will drive it. Young people will make it happen. But a lot of the mentoring, the capital, and the ideas will come from older people. So I think I think something other than retired people has to be used because I think that a lot of people are simply not going to retire. Universal health care. I do think we're going to have to do something on the healthcare issue. It's another one of those issues that's incredibly complicated. Personally, I think they could have made some great progress by doing what Senator Kennedy had suggested with a catastrophic health insurance for people who can't afford insurance. Obviously, portability and tort reform. I mean, there certainly could have been a different system put in. Ultimately, you're going to have some sort of universal health care reform, but it's too complicated an issue for me to tackle, and I'm certainly not the best person. The conventional wisdom decries that China will outcompete the U.S. and become a dominant world power. I think otherwise. I'll tell you one thing. You know, one advantage of being 57, as I can say, I've seen this movie before. If you lived in the 1980s, Japan was going to dominate everything. Japan, I mean, there was testimony in Congress, you know, it's time for the U.S. to step aside. There was the there was Paul Kennedy's book on the rise and fall of nations. The United States was clearly going to decline. There was a huge school about this. There were even some people who said Europe is going to be, you know, it's going to be between Europe and Japan. Turned out to be neither. China, I think, has a lot of fundamental problems long term. If we do nothing, if we continue to erode our productive economy, if we don't invest in education and infrastructure, you know, China may win the day by default. But by all natural reason, the United States has the resources, it has the land mass, it has the diversity of population, it has a constitutional order. I think China is fundamentally an authoritarian country, and authoritarian countries tend to be very brittle. So I still think the U.S. is in a much better shape than China. And, of course, they have all those extra boys, which I wouldn't want to deal with. Okay, one more. Okay, I almost got all of them. Okay, all right, now I got to pick which one. Okay, all right. Here's a point of information I'll answer. Who was the Obama advisor? No, it wasn't Joseph Stiglitz. John Holdren. I spent a couple days reading some of his earlier writings, and let's just say that they were a little bit less than predictive. Anyway, thank you very much. I really appreciate your stay.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.